Okay, my name is Andrew Fabiano. I'm one of the neurosurgeons here at Roswell, and I'll be talking about brain and spine tumors. It's a pretty broad overview of some different types of brain and spine tumors. And at the very end, I have a slide with the learning objectives in which I'll review pretty specifically exactly what you would be expected to know for any sort of test question. So first we'll talk about some brain tumor basics, some types of tumors and cases. We have just a lot of MRIs and presentations. This is a standard brain MRI. These are read, if you envision the person lying down flat and their feet coming out at you. So this is the back of a person's head, the left side, the right side. This is the substance of the brain. You can see here there's an abnormality. It's a tumor, you know, in the center area of the brain. Important point to consider when talking about brain tumors is that the skull is a fixed space. So your skull is bone and it's fixed, and normally that skull is filled with the contents of your brain. And so anytime you have some new growth, such as the tumor you see over on this side of the skull, this is as if as a coronal image, so it's as if you're looking out and you're sliced right in that fashion, and this is your left side and the right side. You can see if you have a tumor growth, it's going to start to push on the brain. And symptoms that patients develop occur once the brain is being pushed on. The brain itself has no pain fibers, so oftentimes these things aren't painful. As the intracranial pressure becomes elevated, people can develop pain. But for the most part, patients will start to develop symptoms based on what area of the brain is being compressed. So you have, just to review your anatomy, you have a frontal lobe. That's going to be control functions such as, in most people on the left side, speech, things like orientation, attention, motivation. The posterior frontal lobe has your motor cortex, which is going to control motor function on the opposite side. Your parietal lobe has the sensory cortex. It is involved in visual spatial functions. Your occipital lobe has the primary visual centers. Temporal lobe on either side has some speech functions, some memory, and again, visual spatial function. And then you have your cerebellum in the back and the brainstem transitioning into the spinal cord. So when you have a brain tumor, inflammation and edema develops in the normal brain around the tumor, and that disruption of normal brain function leads to symptoms. So brain tumors cause edema and irritation of the normal brain. They also cause a breakdown of the blood-brain barrier locally. Initial treatment for brain tumors can include corticosteroids, which are used as a temporary measure to reduce cerebral edema, and anti-epileptics. Anytime the normal brain cortex is irritated, could lead to aberrant brain electrical discharges or seizures. So corticosteroids, dexamethasone, is the medication that's traditionally used. It reduces vasogenic edema. You can see in this image is a CAT scan of the brain. You have this abnormal area of tumor here, and you have a large amount of edema around it. So even sometimes a small tumor can cause a significant amount of edema and a significant deficit in the patient. And by treating the patient with corticosteroids, it can improve that deficit. And corticosteroids have an effect on increased acidity in the stomach, so we always place those patients on GI prophylaxis as well. While corticosteroids work well to temporarily reduce cerebral edema, they have many systemic side effects, and you can kind of see this person: diabetes, myopathy, poor wound healing, increased risk of infection, weight gain. They characteristically get a buffalo hump, an abdominal striae, get wasting of their proximal muscles. So certainly that's not a medication you want to use as a long-term solution. Anti-epileptic drugs are used for cortical lesion. The cerebellum is not epileptic. Epileptic, so it does not require AEDs. Dilantin is the traditional drug. Keppra doesn't require any monitoring. It has less side effects, so it's used frequently to prevent seizures. So tumor types that we'll talk about: gliomas, meningiomas, metastatic tumors, and pituitary tumors. So gliomas arise from native cells within the brain. The gliomas are divided into currently four categories. based on the World Health Organization classification, grade 1, 2, 3, and 4. We'll talk mainly about grade 4, glioblastoma multiforme, which is the most common type of primary brain tumor. Grade 1, pilocytic astrocytoma, is a slow-growing lesion that's not infiltrative, that oftentimes with a complete surgical removal can be cured. Grade 2 and grade 3 are more diffuse infiltrative tumors, and grade 4 glioblastoma is a tumor for which unfortunately there is no cure. So grade 1, the juvenile pilocytic astrocytoma, or JPA, often occurs in kids in the posterior fossa. You get these tumors with an enhancing mural nodule and a cystic component, and if this tumor is totally resected, you can potentially be cured. And you just take a note, this seems to be a discrete mass in these cases with the normal brain pushed away. Grade 2 and grade 3 are not discrete masses. They're infiltrative tumors. They're typically more slow-growing, but these are tumors that oftentimes cannot be surgically resected. In some cases they can, but they would need some additional adjuvant, either chemotherapy or radiation, in order to attempt to treat. Grade 4, the type of tumor we're going to talk about the most, glioblastoma multiforme. Some of the newer nomenclature refers to it just as glioblastoma. It's grade 4, or the most highly aggressive tumor. It's the most common primary brain tumor in adults. It may appear as a discrete mass, but with this type of tumor, we know that the cells always are going to be infiltrating into the normal brain around it. Classically, it tracks along white matter tracks. In this MRI, you see it kind of tracks through the corpus callosum between both hemispheres of the brain. So it's the most common primary brain tumor in adults. The incidence is 3 per 100,000. The average survival from time to diagnosis is approximately 13 months. So it's not a very good prognosis. But there are things that affect that average. And certainly, if patients have a young age, and young age is defined as less than 65, a high performance score, meaning they're independent, are associated with increased survival, as well as a lack of neurologic deficit. The patient has a glioblastoma in an area that's made them unable to walk, the chances of them getting any treatment or aggressive treatment is much lower than someone who's young and walking around and fully functional. So this is a classic MRI example of a glioblastoma. It's a large tumor. It's going through the corpus callosum, involving both hemispheres of the brain. It enhances with contrast, and there's surrounding cerebral edema. Initial treatment when you see a tumor like this is to start the patient on steroids to reduce the cerebral edema, and start the patient on anti-epileptic medications to try to prevent seizures. And this is a pathologic specimen of a patient with glioblastoma, and you can get the sense from this specimen, while you have this main area of tumor here that you might see as abnormal on the MRI, there's multiple areas around it where there are tumor cells. And this is a tumor that probably will never be surgically cured, where surgery certainly plays a role we'll talk about. It's not like there's a discrete mass that you can go and remove. And there's studies where people have taken biopsies of the opposite lobe away from the tumor, and they'll still find tumor cells over there. So even in cases where it looks very discrete on the MRI, this is an infiltrative tumor. So initial treatment can involve, you want to make the diagnosis. So if it's not surgically resectable biopsy, in some cases biopsy followed by surgery, there is a significant benefit to tumor removal. And length of survival is linked with the extent of resection and initial surgery. And all the way up to 97%, there's a correlation between extent of resection and length of survival. And then the standard therapy after a surgery for glioblastoma is a combination of external beam radiation and oral chemotherapy, which is temozolomide, known as Temodar. So this is a recent case. The patient had this right-sided contrast-enhancing mass, and he had weakness in his left hand. I did a functional magnetic resonance image, and this here shows the area where the patient's motor cortex is. It lights up yellow and orange, and what that tells us is the tumor is outside the motor cortex, and he had some weakness on presentation. His weakness was likely from edema in the motor cortex related to the tumor. I was able to safely resect the tumor, and the patient had a return of function in his left hand. And just again, there is a survival benefit related to the extent of resection for glioblastoma. This is a different case. I picked this picture off the internet to give you an idea of the type of radiation treatment plan that this patient would receive. So the typical course in glioblastoma is to resect the tumor if it's resectable. Once the tumor's out, the patient gets what's called IMRT, or fractionated radiation therapy, in which the majority of the radiation dose is given just to the area of the tumor bed, and then there's some radiation dose to the surrounding tissues. But this is a more focused type of radiation in an attempt to spare the other parts of the brain. And the typical course of radiation for glioblastoma is 6 weeks, Monday through Friday. And during that time, the patient will also be taking their oral chemotherapy in the form of temozolomide at home. So standard therapy is a diagnosis, surgery if resectable, and then radiation therapy and oral chemotherapy. Once the patient's undergone their standard therapy, the next stage is monitoring for recurrence. So they're going to have MRIs every 3 months or more frequently to monitor, make sure there's no sign of any tumor recurrence. If there's a recurrence, they're assessed for possible re-resection if it's surgically accessible, and there are multiple additional chemotherapies that can be used. Then this category of patients with recurrent glioma, there's a variety of additional treatments that have been tried in an attempt to slow the disease. Gliadel wafers, these have been used both in recurrent tumors and upfront for initial surgery for glioblastoma. And what these are is it's a mustard-based chemotherapy right within this wafer that's implanted in the wall after the tumor is removed. And the hope is some of that chemotherapy will diffuse out into the brain around the surgical cavity to kill any nearby tumor cells. Vaccines, you're going to hear from Dr. Shishalsky next. He and Dr. Fenstermaker are the inventors of a vaccine here at Roswell that's used to treat glioblastoma. It's used to treat both, again, initially and can potentially be used for recurrent tumors. As you know, with this tumor, it doesn't look like, well, it's not a tumor that's ever going to be surgically cured. There's tumor on other sides of the brain, and so a vaccine offers a lot of potential to improve our ability to treat this disease. Optune, this is a newer treatment. What this treatment involves is patients place these pads on their scalp. They have to shave their head. And the pads, they wear this pack all day long, create a radio frequency that is purported to interfere with mitotic activity and slow tumor growth. So this is a more recent therapy. It has showed some promise. I think the jury's still out on how well it works, but you can get an idea there are a lot of different options, although none of them are that great for recurrent tumor. You know, this is from the company's website, the guy's out enjoying the farmer's market, but you know, in reality, sometimes people have issues with wound breakdown and other problems with this system. Laser interstitial thermal therapy, it's a treatment I do here, involves placing a probe into an area of the brain and heating a laser. The laser transmits a wavelength of light that's absorbed by the tumor and leads to coagulation, necrosis of the cells. There's a picture of my hand during one of the procedures. Again, this is a second-line therapy for glioblastoma. Stereotactic radiosurgery, I'll talk a little bit more about this in a minute, but this is a focused radiation therapy, and it's also used for recurrent glioblastoma. So we're going to skip on to meningiomas in a minute, but as you can see, you know, the important thing is there's a frontline therapy. That our current standard is surgery, as much resection as safely possible, followed by radiation and oral chemotherapy. And then beyond that, there's this kind of pool of different treatments that are used in an attempt to slow that tumor. So switching gears here to meningiomas, these are typically benign tumors. They grow from the dura, or the covering of the brain. And you can get a sense here. Here's a tumor that's attached to the dura, and as it grows in and starts to compress the normal brain, it can lead to symptoms. Here's a pathologic specimen. Here's the dura. Here's the tumor. You can see it made a dent in the brain. And these things grow very slowly over a period of time, years to decades. And so that can allow them to become very large as the brain slowly accommodates around them. So meningiomas develop from arachnoid cap cells in the dura. They're more common in females. Most are WHO grade 1, and the vast majority are benign. There are rare malignant meningiomas. And, you know, the nomenclature that neurosurgeons use is based on where they grow from. So this grows from the olfactory groove, or is it considered an olfactory groove meningioma. You can have a cavernous sinus meningioma or sphenoid wing meningioma, and you can get them down along the skull base as well. So initial treatment, again, can include antiepileptics and corticosteroids. In many cases, they don't require any treatment. So a lot of times, someone will undergo an MRI for a headache. A small meningioma will be found. It doesn't necessarily require any treatment. They'll be followed with serial imaging over time. If it were ever to grow, then it could potentially be treated. If they're small, they can be treated with stereotactic radiosurgery or gamma knife. Larger meningiomas are removed with open surgery. So this is just a case of a 62-year-old female who presented with gait instability. On her physical exam, she had an ataxic gait and a lower extremity hyperreflexia. And you can see here, this is again a coronal image, as if she's sliced down the middle this way. This is her left ear, this is her right ear, this is the top of her head. Here's her brain going into brain stem and spinal cord. And right here is that meningioma growing off to the side at the top of the cervical spinal cord. Okay, so here's an operative video. She's upside down, so this is the back of her neck. The top of her head would be up here. Feet would be down here. This is the tumor right here. And it's showing up pretty bright. The spinal cord is under here. These are the nerve roots, and you can see the tumor's been removed. Once it's removed, you can see the different nerve roots. There's still a small amount of tumor attached to the dura that I'm removing now. You can see this little bit of a tumor that's still there that was attached to the dura. Patties all along the spinal cord, and then once it's removed, also remove the dura that it grows from and sew a patch in to cover that opening in the spinal sac. This is another case. It's a 60-year-old female who presented with a change of personality. Over the past 6 months to 1 year, the patient has been confused and had poor short-term memory. She's always pleasant, which her husband says is unusual. And she was diagnosed with depression with psychotic features, started on an antidepressant, and sent on her way. And on exam, she was obese, she was awake and very pleasant, she was confused, she had poor recall, she had no sense of smell, and she had some difficulty moving her legs. And she had this large olfactory groove meningioma. So the first slice is a sagittal, so this would be her nose up here and her forehead and the top of her head going to her back. See, there's a fair amount of fat back here. This is her brain and the spinal cord and olfactory groove. This large meningioma has grown. And this is, again, coronal. She's sliced down this way. So her left side or right side, you see this large meningioma and the brain around it. And you can see on a T2-weighted image, here's the tumor here. And this is normal brain. And all this brightness is cerebral edema in the normal brain from the large tumor. So she started on steroids and antiepileptics. She underwent a bifrontal craniotomy for tumor removal. Basically, you make an incision all the way across from ear to ear, pull the scalp forward, remove a section of bone, open the covering of the brain, remove the tumor, close the covering of the brain, put the bone back, put the scalp plaque back. Afterwards, you can see on the postoperative MRI the tumor's been removed. And she slowly recovered over 6 months. Just as her symptoms came on slowly, she slowly recovered. Her edema resolved, and by then she was doing crosswords, but she still did have some short-term memory deficit, and she had a major problem with motivation. And that's seen frequently in patients with bifrontal tumors, that they just, you see them, they're nice, they're pleasant, but to get them to get up and do any sort of chore, and even things as simple as, you know, getting up and making meals, they just don't have that motivation. So metastatic tumors are tumors that spread to the brain from other locations, typically occur at the gray-white junction. There may be multiple tumors. So for a single lesion less than 3 centimeters, are typically treated with a gamma knife or stereotactic radiosurgery. Larger metastatic tumors need to be removed surgically, and multiple lesions are frequently treated with gamma knife, rarely require what's called whole brain radiation therapy. The brain itself has a natural blood-brain barrier to protect you over the course of your life. What that does is block most chemotherapy from entering the brain, so some form of radiation therapy or surgery is needed. There are newer chemotherapies, particularly immunotherapy, that gets into the brain, and so there's promise that some of these metastases may now be able to be treated with systemic chemotherapy. Gamma knife radiosurgery is a focused dose of radiation delivered to a target within the brain. You can see here, in most cases, patients will have this frame attached to their skull that allows us to set up a 3D coordinate system to then specifically target an area in the brain. They undergo an MRI with the frame on. You can see the posts of the frame here. And based on that MRI, we target out the areas of metastatic tumor. And then we plan out a radiation treatment plan to target a specific area, a specific tumor within the brain. And this is just an example of a patient with lung cancer. You can see this metastatic lesion here. It was treated with gamma knife radiosurgery, and 2 months later, the tumor's gone. And it's an outpatient procedure. The patient comes in, goes home that same day, so it's really an excellent treatment for metastatic tumors. Leptomeningeal disease, or leptomeningeal carcinomatosis, is the condition where metastatic tumor has spread within the spinal fluid, and it starts to involve the spinal fluid spaces and the dura. This is a very difficult condition to treat because the spinal fluid is in constant motion. So your spinal fluid is constant, and we'll talk about it some more, bathing the brain, traveling around and down around your spinal cord. So it's difficult to target this tumor. So even if you treat them with whole brain radiation, you can imagine sometimes that tumor gets a radiation dose, sometimes it doesn't, it's going to get a different dose each time. And so these patients, unfortunately, have a very poor prognosis. One way to attempt to treat this problem is with intrathecal chemotherapy. That's medication delivered directly to the spinal fluid spaces. And the way we do that is by inserting something called an Ohmyo reservoir. And so it's a little silicone bubble that sits under the skin. It's attached to a catheter that goes through the brain into the fluid spaces in the center of the brain, which are called the ventricles. And in this fashion, you can tap that port and deliver chemotherapy that goes into the spinal fluid spaces and then can spread around to treat tumor cells in the spinal fluid spaces. And this is just an example of a patient. You can see they had this port placed in the fluid spaces in the center of their brain, which are their ventricles, and you can also get a sense how this tumor is kind of spread all around through the brain. And so here's a patient who shared his story online. You can see he's got the incision from where he had his Ohmyo reservoir placed, although typically you want to make the incision in a different direction. And the needle's inserted, and he can come into the office and have spinal fluid sampled or have his chemotherapy delivered. So hydrocephalus is another problem that frequently can be a complication for patients with brain tumors. What hydrocephalus is a buildup of cerebrospinal fluid leading to an increased intracranial pressure. When you have a backup of spinal fluid and increased intracranial pressure, it can lead to headaches, sleepiness, coma, death. Everybody normally has fluid spaces called ventricles in their brain. In these fluid spaces, you make spinal fluid. and the spinal fluid kind of travels through all these ventricles. This is the lateral ventricle to the third ventricle to the fourth ventricle, and then it goes out and it bathes the brain and it bathes the spinal fluid, and eventually at the kind of the top of the brain it gets reabsorbed back into the venous system. You constantly make spinal fluid and you constantly reabsorb it, and you should be doing those things at approximately equal rate. If patients have a backup of spinal fluid, they can develop increased intracranial pressure, and that's what hydrocephalus is. Increased intracranial pressure is a result of a backup of cerebrospinal fluid. As I said, that can lead to headaches, visual problems, and people can start to slowly progress to sleepiness, nausea, vomiting, coma, or death. So there are two types of hydrocephalus, communicating, where you're just not reabsorbing enough so that it starts to back up, or obstructive, meaning you have a mass, like in this case, blocking spinal fluid flow. So you're making spinal fluid up here, but it can't pass down here because the tumor is blocking its normal pathway, and so it starts to build up. So the treatments are, one is you can place a shunt. What a shunt, a ventriculoperitoneal shunt is a small tube that's permanently implanted. One end goes into the fluid spaces in the brain, and then it's tunneled under a person's skin all the way down to their abdominal cavity, which is a naturally occurring fluid space in the body, and you constantly drain off this fluid. And there's a valve to regulate how much is drained off, and you know, this can be a life-saving procedure. Problem with a shunt is it's a mechanical device. It can get clogged up and stop working, can get infected, and need to be removed or replaced. Endoscopic third ventriculostomy, or ETV, is a procedure where an endoscope or a small camera is used to poke a hole in one of these fluid spaces to connect it to another naturally occurring fluid space so the fluid can drain off. So this is a case of a 58-year-old man with a history of colon cancer and worsening headaches and confusion. Patient had just completed external beam radiation for multiple brain metastases, and on physical exam he was confused and sleepy. And you can see here he has these multiple areas of brain metastases and a backup of spinal fluid. And this ventricle is much larger than it should be normally, and it was leading to his confusion, headaches, sleepiness. And so just to give you an idea of how a third ventriculostomy works is you put the camera in through the brain into this lateral ventricle. You pass it through the foramen of Monroe from the lateral ventricle into the third ventricle, and then this is a normally occurring floor of the third ventricle. Typically, the fluid flows down here. If it can't and it gets backed up into the lateral and third ventricle, you can poke a hole in the floor right here, and then this fluid can drain out in front of the brainstem and be reabsorbed. So here's a video of that procedure. First, you take a temporary catheter, which you see right here, which is placed into the ventricle so you know which direction to place your scope through the brain. So we're going to follow this catheter down. This is normal brain around it that you're seeing. But you can follow the catheter, and it'll lead you right into the ventricle. And this way you're not kind of putting the camera all throughout. So now we're in the lateral ventricle. This is the choroid plexus medially. This is the thalamus striae vein. This is your foramen of Monroe. We're passing from the lateral ventricle into the third ventricle. These are the mammillary bodies of the brainstem. This is the floor of the third ventricle. There's typically a translucent area in the floor of the third ventricle. That's going to be the safest area to make your ventriculostomy stoma or hole. And so first you take your camera and kind of make a mark to make sure you're in the right spot. You can see our mark is a little posterior. We want to go a little further ahead to where it's truly translucent. And then you're just going to hold very firm pressure into that floor until you break through. And you can see we're starting to make a hole here in the floor of the third ventricle. It's the infundibular recess of your pituitary gland. And again, we're going to gently pass this through. Once you get through, this is the basilar artery right here. If you damage or nick the basilar artery or any of these perforators into the brainstem, it'll cause death. So you have to be very careful you don't do that. You kind of go back and forth through. This is the skull base. You're looking right at the basilar artery. Down back here is the brainstem. You can see that this is flapping.
There's that little strand right there. That's probably why I went back in again. Again, you can kind of look back and forth. It's clearly flapping up and down now, which is a good sign that the fluid is going through. You can get a peek at the brainstem as you look back and forth. Come back out. There's still that little strand there. Again, you can see how robust the basilar is. It's really flapping well back and forth now. There's that little strand that's still connecting things, but at the same time, with every pass, there's a potential risk of damaging the underlying vasculature of the brainstem. It's flapping well up and down. At this point, I'm usually trying to decide if I should make another pass or not. Again, you can see it go through. It's clear opening for that spinal fluid to pass back and forth through. It's flapping well up and down. I don't think I would do another pass at this point. Let's see what I decided to do. I went for one more. maybe I changed my mind halfway through. That, you know, the job is done. It's working. There's that opening. Now you can see it. You come back out. You check. Here's your fornix. You want to make sure you don't bang into that during the procedure. It'll cause memory problems. And then you come back out through the brain. So changing gears here now to pituitary tumors. The pituitary is a small peanut-sized gland that hangs from the base of the brain just behind the sinuses of the nasal cavity that controls hormone function in the body. It's a marble-sized rather than a peanut-sized gland. It controls hormone regulation in the body. As you can tell, it sends the signals to your reproductive organs, your adrenal glands, your thyroid gland, different organs, to tell them to make their specific hormone, and then it receives feedback from those organs, and that's what allows it to regulate hormone function in the body. And you can get a sense here, we'll talk about later, transphenoidal surgeries, where we go through the nose to operate on the pituitary gland, that this is kind of the trajectory. So the most common tumor are pituitary adenomas. These are usually asymptomatic and usually do not require treatment. I would say a couple times a month, I see a young person who has migraine headaches, who undergoes an MRI. They find a small pituitary adenoma on it. It doesn't require any treatment. You know, they may get imaging once a year to make sure it doesn't change in size. But these are typically benign tumors. Now, if they get real large and start to push on the normal pituitary gland and affect hormone function, or they push on the visual apparatus and affect your vision, then it might require a surgery. There are conditions where you can have a tumor in the pituitary gland that abnormally secretes hormone. One is Cushing's disease, another is acromegaly, and a final is prolactinomas. So pituitary adenomas are typically benign tumors. They're seen in 5 to 15% of the normal population. Most are microadenomas, less than 1 centimeter, and don't require any treatment. Once they become larger than 1 centimeter, they're considered macroadenomas, which typically have a different behavior and may require removal. But the initial treatment, if it's not causing any issues, is observation. If they become large, like this one is, they can start to push on the normal pituitary gland. This line here is your optic chiasm, and oftentimes they'll enlarge and push on the optic chiasm and give patients a classic bitemporal hemianopsia, meaning they lose peripheral vision. And so any patient with a pituitary adenoma of any size is going to undergo endocrine function testing and visual field testing. If the tumor requires surgical resection, they can be treated via transphenoidal surgery, where you go through the nasal cavity, through the sphenoid sinus, and into the pituitary fossa to remove the tumor. And this is an example of one of those surgeries. We're in the sphenoid sinus, looking up. The front of the solid turcica has been removed. The dura, you can see a little bit of it here, was opened to expose the area where the tumor was. And you can see right there, that's abnormal appearing tumor. And so I'm drilling off some additional bone to widen my opening in order to access the area where the tumor is. You can see this tumor is removed kind of as one big chunk. After that, I look around, make sure there's no other signs of tumor.
And once all your tumor is removed, then you have to do a skull-based repair. Because if you just leave that opening, patients will constantly have spinal fluid coming out their nose, which if the spinal fluid can come out, infection can get in and they can get meningitis. So that's actually your optic chiasm right there. It's pulsating. The tumor's been removed. This is the normal pituitary gland in here. So there's another little suspicious piece that I'm removing here. And then once it's all out, you can get a view here of what it's like going through the nose up to that area. We take a piece of fat from the abdomen and place it in the skull base defect. There's this glue-like material that's then sprayed over that to try and firm it up. And then a piece of nasal mucosa is rotated to cover that defect and prevent future spinal fluid leak. Cushing's disease is when you have a ACTH-secreting tumor in the pituitary gland. And patients with Cushing's disease get those same stigmata that you see with excess steroid use. Acne, proximal muscle wasting, truncal obesity, and moon facies and buffalo hump. And that's treated with surgical resection. Acromegaly is when you have a tumor that secretes excess growth hormone. You see these patients develop a very characteristic appearance over time. They have enlarging hands and feet. They can get bilateral carpal tunnel syndrome from increases in the soft tissues in their wrists. They develop diabetes mellitus and dilated cardiomyopathy. Andre the Giant is a famous patient who had acromegaly. He died of a dilated cardiomyopathy. There are some medications to treat this, but it typically requires surgical resection. Prolactinoma, patients may have nipple discharge, they have elevated prolactin, and this can be treated via medication, bromocriptine. So just briefly at the end, we'll talk about spinal metastatic disease. So the most frequent area of the spine for metastasis is to the vertebral body. This is a model of the spine. Here's the vertebrae, the disc, and there's a bony ring around the spinal cord. The spinal cord travels down. Patients may present with pain or neurologic deficit. Once the tumor destroys the vertebral body and alters spinal alignment, you can see here's the spinal canal. That crushed vertebral body can start to push back on the spinal cord or nerve roots and cause a neurologic deficit. General indications for surgery in spinal metastatic disease, neurologic deficit, spinal instability. There's a very good paper that compared surgery followed by radiation therapy versus radiation therapy alone for patients with spinal metastatic disease and spinal cord compression. What they found was, they compared patients with radiation alone, surgery plus radiation for spinal metastatic disease. They found that the surgical group had improved ambulation, improved survival and functional status, and a decreased need for steroids and opioids. And you can see, in some instances, if these are treated with radiation alone, over time they can develop a worsening spinal deformity and spinal cord compression. A patient's overall prognosis is very important when considering a spinal surgery in someone with a spinal metastasis. Patients who have a poor overall prognosis, you don't want them to undergo surgery. Because they're around the time of their operation, they're not going to get chemotherapy or treatment of their primary disease. And so if you take them in for surgery and the rest of their body isn't getting treated, their systemic disease is just going to advance. So you want someone who's a suitable candidate before you would consider a surgery for spinal metastatic disease. Here's a case. It's a 42-year-old female who had colon adenocarcinoma and back pain. On a PET scan, it was hot in the thoracic spine showing tumor activity, and she was hyperreflexic on her exam. And she had this vertebral body had been infiltrated by tumor. You can see a normal vertebral body next to it. This one, the vertebral body is compressed down, and as it's kind of a square block, and as it compresses down, it flattens out. And as it flattens out, it starts to push back onto the spinal cord. So she underwent a transthoracic surgery in which we temporarily deflate one of the lungs to access the thoracic spine. The abnormal vertebral body was removed, a cage was put in its place, and a screw and a plate were put in. So you can see the cage here and the two screws and the plate. Here's a case of an intradural intramedullary metastasis. This is a 66-year-old woman who had left lower extremity pain and weakness. She had a history of renal cell carcinoma, and she developed a radiculopathy and decreased dorsiflexion of her left foot, so she couldn't pick her foot up. You can see here, this is a spine as if you're cut in half. So this is the back and rear end. Here's the abdomen. These are the vertebral bodies of the spine. This is the spinal cord terminus, and you can see this round tumor. And this is your normal spinal canal. Should be all filled with nerve roots or spinal cord, and instead the majority of it is filled by this tumor. So here's a video. She's prone, so this is looking at her back. The posterior elements or posterior bones of her spinal column have been removed. Her head would be up here, her feet would be down here. This is the dura, or the covering of the spinal sac, and that's being opened now. This procedure is done under the microscope. You can see the arachnoid's still intact. Once that is violated, you'll see kind of a rush of spinal fluid. And so this is just carefully opening the dura. You don't want to stick the knife in too far. You could hit the underlying spinal cord or nerve roots. Now the arachnoid's been opened, you can see spinal fluid kind of flushing out. And underneath, here's our nerve roots. And this is a case that's performed with constant neural monitoring. So there's these arachnoid adhesions that you're going to dissect out with microinstruments in order to free up the nerve roots to evaluate them to try to find the area where the tumor is. These nerve roots are being kind of gently retracted to the side. And you can see this purplish area underneath, which is going to be your area of tumor. So again, you free up, constantly are freeing up these arachnoid bands. You don't want to put any tension on the spinal cord. If you pull down or place any tension on the spinal cord, it can cause permanent irreversible injury. So now you can see this purple tumor, and it's kind of attached to a nerve root that's descending down to the patient's lower extremities. So you have to take time to try to dissect off any normal neurologic structures so that they're not damaged. Intraoperatively, we stimulate these, and when we stimulate them, we can tell if they're functional or non-functional. This one I was able to determine was non-functional, so it's coagulated and incised in order to separate the tumor out from that nerve root. And you carefully cut it. You don't want to cut any normal nerve structures. Now we're able to hold up this tumor. Again, we're going to separate off every nerve fascicle. When we find one that's attached to the tumor, we stimulate it first to make sure it's non-functional. If that's the case, then it can be coagulated and then incised. And once it's cut, I think that frees up the tumor. And oh, it's still attached a little bit there. You look around and make sure it's completely separate before you tug, and then it's separated and removed. And you can see, as soon as we irrigate, now these nerve roots are going to go back to fill the entire spinal canal as they normally would. So you take one last look, as always, make sure you got every last bit of tumor. There isn't any stuff hiding in there. Okay, the nerve roots look like they're in a proper position. And then once that's done, we're going to sew up the dura in order to create a watertight closure so there isn't persistent spinal fluid leakage over time. See, there's a stitch, and there it is, you know, completely sewn up. And under postoperative MRI, you can see now that that tumor's been removed. So in summary, consider surgery when evaluating patients with spinal metastatic disease and patients with a neurologic deficit from spinal cord compression in greater than 6 months prognosis are the best surgical candidates. So learning points. So any test questions will come from here. Dexamethasone side effects. So the initial slide with the guy that lists all the side effects, you just want to know those. Proximal muscle myopathy, increased weight gain, buffalo hump, that's a nice all of the above question. High-grade glioma, glioblastoma, you want to know that glioblastoma is WHO grade 4. Glioblastoma is the most common primary brain tumor in adults. There's not a surgical cure for glioblastoma. Standard therapy can include
biopsy, surgery, concurrent chemotherapy and radiation. If there's a question, which of all of these are potential treatments for glioblastoma, all those things we talked about, stereotactic radiosurgery, Optune, vaccine, that's another all of the above question. Meningioma, so we talked about standard GBM therapy. Meningioma is a benign tumor that grows from the dura or the covering of the brain. It's typically, most likely, a WHO grade 1 tumor. Hydrocephalus is increased intracranial pressure due to the buildup of cerebrospinal fluid. Treatments of hydrocephalus include ventriculoperitoneal shunt and endoscopic third ventriculostomy, both. Intrathecal chemotherapy is medication delivered directly to the cerebrospinal fluid spaces. Pituitary tumors might be a question. The pituitary tumor can affect hormone function in the body, can affect vision. That would be both. Indications for spine surgery, neurologic deficit, spinal instability are both indications for spine surgery. Thank you.
Any questions? Okay.
Okay, so we'll totally change gears here. And I got to jump out and throw a disclosure out quickly that the stuff I'm going to talk to you about, I also hold a patent and may also be a co-founder of the company that's developing them, but I promise not to be too biased. What I want to go over with you guys today is translation of basic science from the lab to the clinic, and the process that we'll go through clinical trials and try that famous bench to bedside myth. Sounds really cool. It's something you'll have a lot of buzzwords out in the media about. Everybody wants to have a bench to bedside process to bring medicine from basic research to the clinic. The process itself is very complex, time-consuming, and costly. It can take 10 to 15 years at least, and in many cases can cost even more than $1 billion to bring a single product from the lab bench to the clinic. And the really unusual thing about it is that for every drug that does make it, 5,000 to 10,000 other drugs did not. And that's due to a whole host of reasons between financial, efficacy, motivation, and just general hurdles in trying to move the thing through. This is the cover of Time magazine just this week, just showing that immunotherapy is really moving to the forefront of cancer treatment. It's kind of taking place as the third primary treatment alongside radiation, chemotherapy, and surgery. So I guess the fourth, we'll look at it that way. The reality is that the bench to bedside is much more of an abyss, and what we refer to it as is the valley of death. When I started doing a lot of the work here, I'm from the basic science work in neurosurgery, so we're developing a lot of drugs on plates, treating a lot of mice, and we found ourselves curing cancer cells on a dish pretty easily. We can cure cancer in a mouse pretty easily. But then you look on the other side, and you've got glioblastoma patients over there that are receiving the same treatments they did 10, 15 years ago. There's a couple of small incremental advances along the way. But all the cool stuff we're doing in the labs never really seems to make it to the other side. And we kind of made a commitment that that's something that we want to try and help bridge, and that's what we've been doing ever since. This is the pathway that drugs will move. Essentially, you have the discovery, you have your idea, all you guys have that. And then we get to the basic research phase, which is all the lab work that's going on. The reality here is that only 10% of basic research ever gets attempted to put into a clinical trial. And of that 10%, only 1% move it on to phase two clinical trials. At that point, then things are fairly steady, not too bad, and a lot of those of that 1% make their way on and get to patient care. What's unusual is that while only 10% make it out of basic research, 50% of basic research is never even attempted to move into clinical. That's kind of a deficiency of the field. If more things are moving along, getting pushed towards the clinical side, you may have more treatments coming through. But a lot of it is just not even tried. So to bridge basic science into clinical science, there's a few steps. So you have your concept, and you start to look at efficacy. This is something you do in the lab. I mean, obviously, if it works, you want to move it forward. If it's not working, move on. The first hurdle you run into is preclinical manufacturing. How do you make lots of this stuff? And it's something that's not always apparent when you start working in a lab with microgram or milligram quantities of a drug. That to move it into the clinic, suddenly now you need grams or kilograms of the stuff. And a lot of that's due to your preclinical toxicity studies that the FDA requires you to do, that you say would be using 500 micrograms for your dose for a patient. The FDA wants you to put 5 grams of that into a mouse to see if there's any toxicity. So you're going to burn up an awful lot of resources trying to generate that much material to get through your toxicity studies. So these are two of the very early hurdles for translating clinical medicine. Then comes that everything you do has to be done to GLP, good laboratory practices, which is something everybody should be doing in the lab. Most aren't, but it's something to kind of strive to. What's important to recognize is that GLP is a process. It's keeping track of everything in the lab. It's based around SOPs, standard operating procedures. So everything in the lab has a logbook associated with it. When you used it, how you used it, what the conditions were for the day, what's the humidity of the lab, temperature of the lab, all that kind of stuff. It's all recorded as part of good laboratory practice. And everything you do gets put into a log, and end of the day would have a report and somebody signs off on it. And this kind of gives some credibility to everything that's done in the lab. As you come time to do clinical trials, this is what the FDA looks for, and if it's not done to GLP, certified GLP, they give you a little bit of wiggle room to explain why not, and hopefully it's okay, but for the most part, they won't accept any studies that aren't GLP. They basically didn't exist if they were not GLP. So as you're building up, you want to have this ready before you get to that point. And if I was thinking of something to put on an exam, something like that might be a really good short answer question. So you might want to put a star next to it. The other half of the equation is GMP, which is often confused, GLP and GMP. But they are totally different in concept. GMP is a system, which is more pointing towards your production of a reagent. So this is the batch record that accompanies that reagent. So this is to say where the raw materials came from. Were they pure? Were they sterile? Were they stable? What did you do with them? How did you mix them? This is kind of the protocol part to some degree of what was handled. And this includes things right down to the serial number and the lot numbers and the bottle of water you used, the last time your pipettes were calibrated, dates and everything, temperature of the room, that kind of stuff. Again, another pretty good short answer question if I was thinking of one. Okay, moving on. So getting from your preclinical studies to the clinic. You've done your animal toxicity, and that has to actually use the GMP product. So this is a lot of cost that's built into these clinical development and why they're so expensive. You're dumping an enormous amount of your product into your animals for toxicity. It's done under GLP, which adds to the labor and the cost and the paperwork and all that fun stuff. So if you have no toxicity, it's great. Now you can move on and write your IND. Now, what's the IND? Well, that's the Investigational New Drug Application. That's what you submit to the FDA, which is basically your license to go ahead and do a clinical trial. And this is centered around three main parts. It looks at your chemistry, manufacturing, controls. That's basically who made your drug product, was it GMP, better be GMP, and everything that went into creating that. The clinical trial document is your clinical protocol, which is more locally controlled. So that's the institutional review board who goes through and says, the protocol's good, we'll go ahead and approve it. And then your farm tox section, which is looking at your PK and pharmacodynamic studies of your drug and your animal toxicity studies. So the FDA is going to look at all that, but what are they really interested in? It comes down to basically these four things. They're going to look at drug stability, purity, if it's sterile, free from infectious agents, pyrogens, contaminants, and safety. And they usually look at two different species of animals. What's really interesting at this point is that the one thing the FDA does not look for, and to some degree could care less about at this point, is efficacy. They kind of look at it that if you've brought it this far, the onus is on you that this thing better have some reason to be put into a clinical trial. They don't care about it right now because they just want to make sure that it's safe. That's all they're looking at. You're not going to hurt somebody putting it in, and if you can prove your efficacy and responses later on, fine. But efficacy or safety is all that they want to know. So the IND itself can have multiple forms. It's a living document. So once this thing is filed, everything that happens with your drug is appended to it, usually in an update once a year. So even though you've submitted all this in an application, everything you do in the lab from that point forward gets collected and thrown into this thing, which is another reason why everything better be GLP at that point, because now you're getting bits of data and you've got some conflicting data. You want everything to be organized and let the FDA know where to find these things. They want to be aware of anything that could affect the safety profile, and they're going to be looking for that. And you want it to be nice and organized so they can find it as you keep appending it. If they can't find it or confused or just kind of not working well with that IND, they'll just shut you down. And you've got nowhere to go, nowhere to fix it, and you're done. So let's strive for that. So preclinical to clinical, step three. Now you're talking to the FDA. You've submitted your preliminary IND plan, and now you have meetings. And the funny thing with the FDA is you're only allowed three of these meetings, and they're kind of these cryptic discussions. We did ours, there were 10 of us sitting around a table at Roswell on a conference call, and the FDA will tell you what they think of your IND and what they want you to do. There's no discussion around it. So they'll come back and say, well, we think your stability assays should be done this way. And basically your response is, yes, sir. So it's a difficult, weird kind of conversation. In our case, we've engaged with the Center for Biologics Evaluation. There's several of these at the FDA. There's ones for drugs, ones for DNA products, all that kind of stuff. But they all look at the same basic stuff. They're all looking for your CMC stability, activity assays, toxicity, and then how you've designed your phase one trial. So when's it okay to open your phase one trial? Well, once you submit your IND, it starts what's called the countdown clock. And the FDA has 30 days to review your IND, and they'll then ask for clarifications or other documentation. They can put it on clinical hold if they think it's really bad. And if you don't hear anything in 30 days, you can automatically go ahead and open the trial and start treating your patients. So no news is good news. Usually, though, they will start to respond on day 28 or 29. So on to what I do with the lab and where we've developed our own vaccine that Dr. Fabiano referred to. We're looking at glioma immunotherapy. So the funny thing about malignant gliomas is they don't metastasize. And we're pretty good at removing the tumor. It's just we're not so good at removing the microscopic disease, which extends all through the brain. In some other cancer, you can remove a margin of tissue around the tumor and get a little more ahead of it, but you probably shouldn't be doing that with brain tumor surgery. At least, hopefully, we're not doing that. After resection, another funny thing happens in gliomas is that the immune responsiveness temporarily returns to these patients, at least until the tumor recurs. So generally in cancer, the tumor is sending out all sorts of immunosuppressive materials, which pretty much cools off the immune system, so you can't get a good immune response. Glioma is a little different. So that comes out, and you got a little bit of an opportunity to get a vaccine in there and try and boost an immune response. What we're looking at is a target called survivin. This is an inhibitor of apoptosis protein, which has a lot of other complex functions. It's found intracellularly, it's found nuclear, it's found cytoplasmic, it's in the mitochondria, it's presented on the outside with MHC class 1, all sorts of different positions. There's not as much known about it as we think we do. But it is very limited in expression in normal cells, and its expression in tumors is associated with a very poor prognosis. Present in 95% of glioblastomas and many other cancers. And this is important because when you do something that you want to target in tumors, you want something that's expressed in a lot of them, not just one small subset, 5% of this tumor, or special characteristics. You need something that you can test. You've got a good clinical population to run it to. If you're in a rare type cancer, you can get into a clinical trial situation where you're recruiting patients for years trying to get to your patient accrual, and you just never do it. So what the vaccine that we're doing is called Cervaxem. It's a molecular mimic, which means it's been enhanced to bind MHC class 1, which is the antigen-presenting molecule for dendritic cells, macrophages, to present to T cells and boost an immune response. So it's different in that it's not the wild-type peptide, but it still produces a response that's cross-reactive to wild-type survivin. So you're kind of tricking the immune system into responding to this unnatural peptide, which is cross-reactive and hits the wild-type. It's also a long peptide. When you have a vaccine, usually they're kind of spearheaded with the CD8 T-cell response. And CD8 cells respond to a very short amino acid sequence of 8-9 amino acids. If you start to expand that, make it longer, you can drag in CD4 help, which like to respond to 10 to 14 amino acid long sequences. And that helps feed the CD8 response and keep the whole immune response going. In addition, it's large enough that you can get an antibody response. So what we've done is tried to get all arms of the immune system converging on the tumor with the specificity of specific CD8s and specific CD4s and antibodies. Some of the characteristics of the vaccine. So this is wild-type survivin, just a structure. And the changes that we've done to it are kind of in the circled area, which really only result in this extra little hook coming in there. But it doesn't alter the overall structure of the peptide. So that's how it retains its ability to be cross-reactive against the wild-type peptide. But in doing that little hook, we've increased the binding to MHC class 1 by about 130 times. So it's a huge, huge boost. So it enhances MHC binding, stimulates a potent immune response because now it's also recognized as foreign, and it's cross-reactive to the wild type. This is kind of what altered peptide recognition a peptide mimic does. So you have a normal peptide presented by a dendritic cell or any cell with MHC class 1, T cells won't respond to that. These guys should have been deleted during development, and this is why you basically don't liquefy your own body out of T cell responses. So as it goes on and finds one presenting the mimic peptide, it will respond to that and activate and create a larger population of activated T cells, which will then go and hunt out the cells that are expressing the wild type, because it's cross-reactive, it'll hit both of these guys and hopefully ends up killing it. This is kind of a characterization of how the peptide was developed in starting with small amino acid sequences. This is an intracranial glioma model, which isn't all that important, but what is important is watching how the survival curves continually shift over to the right. So this is a small version with a single CD8 T-cell epitope, which does a little bit better than the control mice who died around day 20. As we made this peptide a little bit bigger and started to draw in some CD4 help, survival kind of doubled. We got a little bigger and a little more. And as we moved on, we started to get the antibody response, and now we've got some cures coming out of the mice. And this is the peptide that eventually became the vaccine. This is a little bit more of a larger experiment, the same thing, more mice, same effect. But I put it in here just because it shows some MRIs of the mice with tumor, and those are vaccinated with tumor, so you can see the effect right in the brain. So this is the vaccine and the strategy that we went with. It's a peptide coupled to a protein called KLH, which is keyhole limpet hemocyanin. And this is just a large carrier molecule that will also cause a kind of a localized allergic reaction. So it draws in the immune system, macrophages eat it all up, present better. We give it with some GM-CSF, which is another dendritic cell stimulant. And from that, we get CD4, CD8 antibody converging on the tumor. Now, when we did this, we did everything GLP, GMP. We had a company make this peptide for us, but one thing that the company didn't pay attention to, and we never noticed and anybody caught, was that while all the amino acid raw materials for the peptide were GMP, nobody noticed that the KLH that they had used was not GMP. So they took a stock GMP, which was 99% pure, it was good stuff, but because it wasn't GMP, when we submitted the IND, the FDA caught that and ended up putting us onto a clinical hold for non-GMP KLH, which means everything stops, we go back, and we have to resynthesize the vaccine. So it's good that it's at this point prior to clinical trials, didn't kill anybody, didn't cost a whole lot because the trial didn't get wasted. So we go back and look at it. First off, the keyhole limpet is where the KLH comes from. It's kind of a snail-like mollusk. And it's a blood product that is purified from these guys and produces the immune response. Turns out they only exist in a small bay off of San Jose. And the reason that the FDA didn't want us to use the non-GMP was that, in their thinking, Los Angeles is upstream and Los Angeles dumps sewage into the ocean. So their thought was that that could make its way down to San Jose and that the keyhole limpets could be infected with cholera or a whole other host of diseases, and that if we used the KLH from them, we could transfer diseases to humans, even though there's not been a single documented case of this ever happening since the history of time, but we're the lucky recipients of the FDA decision. So what we ended up having to do is resynthesize using aquacultured keyhole limpet mollusks. So there's actually a company in San Jose that grows these guys in sterile aquariums and produces the blood and this whole rigmarole. But it gets down to why drugs cost so much, and that's because the non-GLP KLH was $60 a gram. The now GMP KLH is $18,000 a gram and the most expensive component in the whole vaccine. So phase one trial design, something else you want to pay a lot of attention to. You want to use, what we did is survive in positive malignant gliomas. We wanted to make sure that the tumors we're targeting were expressing the antigen target in the trial. So you don't want to have a patient come in that's not expressing your target and put them on an immunotherapy trial that they can't even respond to. So you want to keep that out. HLA restriction, this was something early on that we expand as we go, but you want to have only patients that have documented a immune response to that particular HLA allele. So this kind of gets into the GLP studies to some degree, that the only ones that we could include were ones that we had GLP lab studies on that were confirmed reactive to the peptide. You know, everybody else probably reacts to it. Until we had those studies developed, we can't include the other alleles like HLA 11 or 24, that kind of thing. We had 9 patients, and they get in an adjuvant called Montanide, which is kind of like an oily carrier, GM-CSF. And you look at 3 things, at least in a phase 1 clinical trial. Primarily, you're looking at for toxicity, tolerability, immunological effects. And this is all the FDA is really concerned about. So this is what they're watching. Anything else you get from this is a bonus prize. So you try and work that into the trial, because the trials are a lot of money. You want to see whatever you can get, and the more information you get from one trial helps the next trial down the road. So also we're looking for progression-free survival and overall survival, and a radiological response. So you want to see tumor shrinkage on an MRI. This is the first set of results. This was the immunological response from the trial. And it's looking at a tetramer study. So this is where you take a peptide hooked up to an artificial MHC molecule and you screen your patients to see if they responded to that particular peptide, and this will give you a flow cytometry readout. All that's important is that the top two are two different CD8 T cell populations, and as the weeks go on, this upper quadrant builds and builds and builds. So there's an increase of T cells that are reactive against the tumor. And this is a control down here, so you're kind of negative. As well as the patients that have some residual tumor, we were able to get some sections out of and see that they have T cells that have infiltrated the tumor. So all looks good. These are the study results. Immunotherapy works a little different than chemotherapy radiation in that it doesn't affect the progression-free survival all that much. So patients dropped off fairly quick in that they recurred. What should back up, though, is this is in recurrent glioma patients. When you do a phase one, you don't get to go to the choice newly diagnosed patients. You have to go and use patients that have no other available treatment options for them. So this is kind of their last ditch. It's a toxicity trial. You're trying to see if it's safe. All these patients have had a glioblastoma. It's recurred on them once or twice. They've had surgery again, gone through chemo a couple times, and they have nothing else left. That's where we pick them up. So progression-free is not that great, but the overall survival is what we look at. So a recurrent glioblastoma patient has an average life expectancy of about 6 months. As you can see from here, 7 out of 9 of the patients that we treated all made it past 12 months. So it doubled survival in that aspect. 3 of them even made it out past 24 months. And the last guy, who was actually the first one we treated, is now approaching almost 4 years out with no evidence of disease. He's totally cured. So it was a pretty good turnout for him. This is actually his MRI scan. So you can see his original tumor recurred and went on vaccine, and then over a period of 3 years, there's nothing left in the tumor cavity. So this was the first in human clinical trial for recurrent malignant glioma. Appeared to be safe, tolerable. For vaccines, you only get mild immune side effects, just injection side effects, rashes, fatigue, myalgias. We got CD8 cells, CD4s, antibodies, and importantly, no autoimmunity observed. This is something else the FDA is really concerned about that really hasn't been seen in very many patients. So moving from phase one to phase two, so phase one is your initial testing. It's usually a small number of patients, and you want to determine if the drug is reasonably safe. Going to phase two, now you want to evaluate the candidate's effectiveness in a group of patients, usually 30 to 300. Now you're looking more at side effects and potential risks, and you're starting to dig into its actual effectiveness. Now the FDA is starting to take notice of the efficacy. So we're moving into a phase two, which we've started. So right now we have 50 patients, and we've moved up to newly diagnosed patients. So we've moved out of that recurrent setting into a zone where we think they might have a better immune response. So we can get them right after surgery, right when that vaccination window appears, maybe they can get a better response. We can include more HLAs because in the process of doing the phase one, we're able to do these side studies which incorporate more GLP studies for more HLA reactivity. So we can add 11 to 24, and we just keep going as patients are enrolled, and we can add, hopefully get rid of HLA restriction entirely. Now we're looking at progression-free survival as a primary endpoint because you're in the newly diagnosed patients, so you got a better window of something to look at. These patients have a better chance of having a response that is a readout in their progression-free survival. You compare it to historical controls, which are pretty good. And again, 95% of all glioblastomas express survivin, which is important in a slide coming up. So then now it's a larger trial, so we're going to look at secondary, overall survival, imaging, immune responses. And once you're in the system, you got this thing going, your IND is filed, you submit it for 30 days and move along. In this case, we never heard from the FDA. We're kind of nervous on day 31, 32. Do we enter a patient? All right, let's go for it. Never heard from them. All good. So right now, I can't give you any more data on this because we've only entered 11 of 50 patients, but it's churning along. In general, if phase two would work good, you move on to phase three, where you're now tested in a large group, sometimes 1,000 or more patients. You're looking at safety, efficacy, you're using a double-blind randomized procedure, so you're comparing it back to a real control. So you want your control arm to be identical to the treated arm, same characteristics. These are something that moves out to the large pharmaceuticals because on average they're about $20 million a piece. And if that all works out, then you get to file your new drug application, which then the FDA compiles everything you've sent, all your GLP studies, verifies that they're still GLP, we're done with GMP, reviews it, and if everything's all good, you get approval from FDA and you can go ahead and start marketing this thing to patients and really get it into the clinic. So there are a couple of pitfalls. Some of them are simple. So when you're writing a clinical protocol, you get a deluge of protocol amendments down the road of things that probably we should have done differently than when we wrote the protocol. And this can be simple things. You know what, we need 5 tubes of blood to do the procedure that we want to do to test for immune response. Turns out we wrote the protocol only to include 3. Well, you have to submit another amendment to the IRB and have that approved just so you can collect an extra tube of blood. And there's deviations, and this is the whole reason for GLP, GMP in the first place. Not because a deviation is necessarily bad, but you want to know where things are and where you can trace them back to. So if something goes on down the road, you know where the problem is in the chain, and you could fix it fairly easily. And GMP is designed so that anybody can pick up and look at those studies and figure out where that problem was. We used a bottle of unsterile water or something like that. But it was in a wash, so it didn't really matter, and it was sterilized down the road, so it should be okay. So that's kind of a deviation. It doesn't really hurt things, but it's not the way the protocol is supposed to go. Make note of it, move on. And there's always more paperwork with the clinical trial. On the other side, there's the not-so-simple stuff, which is your fatal trial design, lack of financing, or the drug just doesn't work. And sometimes you don't know that till you're knee-deep in the clinical trials. Now, I kind of bring that up because recently another vaccine company doing glioblastoma research went completely belly up on their pivotal phase 3 study. This was earlier this month, a company called Celvex. They're targeting a glioblastoma antigen called EGFR variant 3. It's a mutation of the epidermal growth factor receptor. Similar, it's a peptide vaccine. So they're in phase 3, and all their studies up to date got about 20-month survival, which was great because newly diagnosed glioblastoma patients only live about 14, 15 months on average. So this was a really strong advance. Unfortunately, this was the first study that they did where they controlled it with a randomized control arm that also expressed EGFR variant 3. So up until that time, they had been comparing back to glioblastoma populations as a whole, not really recognizing that, you know, if you super select a small group of molecular characteristics in a tumor population, you might have a different survival curve. And as a result, that's exactly what happened. Glioblastoma is actually a mix of 4 different types of glioblastoma-like tumors. This is why it used to be called glioblastoma multiforme. Since then we've dropped the multiforme, now it's just glioblastoma. But there's mesenchymal, classical, neural, and proneural. And they're all very, very similar, but they have slightly different molecular fingerprints to them. And one of the characteristics is if you take as a whole, it's 14 to 16 months survival. But this EGFR mutation they're looking at was only present at about 20% of one part of the category. So if you focus your entire trial on that, the survival arms change. So if you look at classical EGFR-expressing glioblastomas, they break away from the rest of the population and do a little bit better. If you look at only the ones that express this variant 3 mutation, they break way out of the curve and actually have a median survival of about 20 months, which is what these guys proved that their drug was. So the drug really didn't have any effect. So millions of dollars out, a lot of hopes on this company. And kind of the sad thing is that this was data that was published in 2010, which was 2 years prior to them even starting the phase three trial. So a little bit of due diligence could have helped immensely. But you're still not there, because then comes the commercialization process. You got to figure out how to get this into the clinic, which deals with your patenting and foreign patents, sublicensing, intellectual property. Are you going to go public to get the money to do it? Marketing, investment partners. So it's, you know, one fishbowl into another one. But we'll save that for another talk. Kind of a quick rundown just to get an idea of what all this takes to get into from bench to bedside. This is kind of the timeline that we ran through. I mean, it's not necessarily difficult, but it does take a lot of time. I would say we probably invented the peptide around 2006, filed a patent in 2008, and then went through all of our FDA stuff. That takes about 6-7 years. Get to the clinical trial. Oddly enough, the phase one only takes about a year. And then here we are moving into phase two and moving on to some other cancers along the way. So the whole thing takes about, you know, 10, 15 years, like they said, to get it developed. So something to consider. But the end game of clinical translation is efficacy and safety. And that's what the FDA is going to look at. That's what you've got to keep in mind. And that's the whole point of all the GLP and GMP studies. And the sooner you adopt GLP into what you're doing now, the better off you are down the road, because you can use all that stuff later on to support whatever you're doing, be it your doctoral thesis, anything like that. The more that it's GLP-like, the better off the data is going to be, the more believable it's going to be, easier to publish, easier to get to FDA, all that kind of stuff. And even though you're trying to get it through clinical trials and it's kind of a chore, the important thing is to remember the end game. This is the Roswell Park Alliance report from last year, and this is actually our patient who has survived for 4 years, which is really unusual for any glioblastoma patient. There's a bell over in the lobby over there that cancer patients get to ring if they're cancer-free. As far as I know, he's the only glioblastoma patient that's been able to ring that. So something to drive home to at the end of it. And that's about all I got. Any questions or anything? I'm around.